Okay, now that Peter's arrived, I think I might as well start. So welcome everybody this evening to LOC for this public lecture. My name is Uli Sedlmayr. I'm an associate professor in the International Relations Department. And I'm very pleased to welcome this evening John Peavyhouse, who's a professor of political science and political methodology at the University of Madison at Wisconsin at Madison. John is a leading scholar on international institutions. He is currently the editor of International Organization, not just a leading journal on international organizations, but arguably in international relations more generally. And I should probably also say, if I introduce John as an expert on international institutions, I don't want to do him this justice. I mean, he has contributed to the broader discipline of international relations. He's the co-author of one of the leading textbooks in international relations. He's the co-editor of the Oxford Handbook on International Political Economy. And maybe I should also say that for somebody working in international institutions, maybe I should speak for myself, but unusually he's not somebody who knows one international institution really well, but he's equally at home writing on international human rights institutions, international trade institutions, regional institutions. So it's quite impressive the breadth of institutions that he covers at that particular level. And I would say, luckily for us, John is not just an outstanding scholar, he's also extremely generous with his time. So he's coming here, he came here to examine a PhD thesis. He's given a talk in a PhD workshop this afternoon. And now it's our pleasure to welcome here this evening for his talk, which is called The Future of Global Governance and the Fall of International Organizations. After the lecture, there will be time for questions and answers, but now, welcome, John.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Uli. And it's my pleasure to be here. And I'm glad I was put to work, because it's a treat to come to London and interact with great students, great faculty, and lots of friends that I get to reacquaint myself with. So the title, you know, today, The Future of Global Governance and the Fall of International Organizations, was purposefully meant to be somewhat controversial, and so hopefully some of you came because of the title, because that's what I was going for. What I'm going to talk about today is global governance and the landscape of global governance as you see it today and potentially in the next 10 to 15 years. As Uli mentioned, I do work on a number of different international organizations, both at the theoretical level and the empirical level. One way to think is, jack of all trades, master of none. But what I'd like to show you today is an ongoing project that is about to be some new data that it's very close to being released, trying to catalog state memberships and the population of memberships in international organizations over the past 200 years. And in some of those trends, and looking at some of these trends and some of these developments in these international organizations, I want to try to raise some questions both about international relations theory, about how IR theory has treated international organizations, and I also want to raise some practical public policy questions, given things like the rise of Donald Trump in the United States and what direction that may take us when thinking about actual international cooperation in the world as we see it. So, global governance is an area of research, an area of both theory and empirical work in international relations that has a long history. The first use of the word dates back to some of Jim Rosenau's writings in the 1970s. Rosenau thought of global governance as the various institutions, both non-governmental and international institutions, that help govern essentially externalities between states. That is, helping states learn to cooperate and helping cooperation over various issues over time. Now global governance in 2017 means a lot of things, and there is a massive literature on global governance that has really started to create all kinds of, you can think about adjectives to modify global governance. So there's a strand of literature that talks about multi-stakeholderism, right? The number of different actors that are now trying to get input on public policy when it comes to global governance, whether it's in economics, in labor policy, et cetera. There's also this idea of the post-Westphalian model, right, where non-governmental organizations are are at the forefront of thinking about international organizations. Pluralization, Copernican, the list is long. This was just an initial search on a few recent papers published thinking about global governance, trying to apply different words to describe, what's changing. Because there's a general sense in both in the policy world and certainly in the academic world that global governance is changing. And that's what I want to talk about today. No longer is the formal international organization or intergovernmental organization the central hub or central node of efforts at global governance. And we can debate whether they ever were, but I'm going to try to make the case that in the post-World War II era, for quite some time, they were. So global governance is changing. How is it changing? I would argue that, again, just going back to Rosenau's initial conceptualization of sort of cross-border externalities is a good place to start, and then you can decide whether you want to use any fancy adjectives to further describe it as it exists today. So global governance has been evolving. And when I say our, I should mention this is work that is joint with Michael Barnett at George Washington University and Cal Rastiala at UCLA Law. And so what we've been sort of thinking about is why is global governance evolving? Like, why now? Why are people recognizing this over the last decade? What leads to this recognition and what has led to these trends? So there's all kinds of famous scholars, important scholars writing on this. John Ruggie argues that global governance architectures, legal and institutional, are set to be fragmenting. Bob Cohane and David Victor, writing about regime complexes, suggest that comprehensive integrated regimes are no, at least when it comes to climate, are no longer feasible. That is, projects like Kyoto are sort of dead on arrival. We can't expect them to work because the system is just not gearing itself towards these large multinational solutions, you know, one-shot, 180-member organizations working anymore. Greg Raymond, when talking about internet governance and global internet governance, talks about an inchoate set of global institutions surrounding technology. Bruce Jenelson has highlighted the fact that power is diluted, norms are contested. He argues states are still central. We might want to start questioning that, and I'll try to question that today. Craig Murphy talks about global governance is unable to deal with normative issues, right, and that normative issues should be at the front of how scholars and practitioners think about issues, whether it's development, climate, trade, labor, et cetera. Tom Weiss in New York basically says, in comparisons with IO, international organization, peering through the lens of global governance opens analysts' eyes to a host of actors and informal processes of norm and policy formulation. That is, there are lots more informal processes, many more actors now involved in global governance. This should not be news to us. We've seen this going on for quite some time. One of my arguments and one of our arguments, in fact, is that, all of these folks saying things are different, things are changing, hasn't led to us changing our theories about international institutions and international cooperations in concomitant ways. Why is the change happening? Well, it's not hard to empirically verify, right? The number of non-governmental organizations, non-state actors involved in making rules, in guiding legislation, in making things happen in international organizations is on the rise. Of course, there are certain organizations like the WTO that receive a lot of criticism for not allowing some of these non-state actors to become involved. But across the board, in almost every issue area, there has been at least some rise in international organizations, in non-state actors in international organizations. Another trend we're seeing is an increase in the number of small agreements. So take climate, right, where you've had side agreements at the major conferences on global warming between some of the major actors like the US and China in the most recent round, after Paris, right, small agreements after Copenhagen. And so you're getting these side, and this is where Rastiala and Victor say in climate, like we should frankly start giving up hope that we're ever going to get a unified solution to climate. And what we have to hope for are small agreements. The same has been said of international trade. Every time, you know, the WTO, the continued sort of lack of progress in the Doha round has led a lot of states to make side agreements when it comes to trade, both in services and in goods. And so people are seeing this sort of devolution into smaller agreements. And do our theories predict this? Do we have anything to say about it? Does it matter? An increase in public-private governance. That is, it's no longer just states that are creating binding or even loosely binding protocols for states. Public-private cooperation, which again is not new by any stretch, but it seems to be happening with increasing frequency. The rise of networks. So we don't have a lot of great data on this across issue areas, but in some places like global health where we do know, we've seen over the last 20 years the rise of networks between public-private governance organizations, NGOs, IOs, all of these constellation of actors that are out there trying to solve problems, right? Again, whether it's health, climate, facilitate trade, labor protections, human rights, et cetera. Increasing fragmentation of regimes, that is, those large regimes that do exist, these large international organizations that do exist and operate, and we hope do some good, are starting to fragment. One of the quickest rises, one thing that is increasing in the world of international organizations are something we call emanations. Right? These are organizations that are, in fact, made by other organizations, in some cases without the approval of the states that fund the home organization itself or the parent organization itself. In fact, emanations are growing incredibly quickly, given that international organizations, as a traditional form of organization, has stopped rising. And in fact, I'll show you some data in a second suggesting it's the number of these organizations are starting to decline. So where I take this and where my co-authors, I think, and I are going with this is that there's just been a decline in centrality of intergovernmental organizations in global governance. And you've got all these other actors becoming important. Again, none of this is new. But if you look at some of our core theories of international relations, neoliberal institutionalism, institutionalist theory, international liberalism, liberal theory, you know, there's some ways to sort of contort an explanation out of some of these theoretical foundations, but it's fairly hard. And again, there's a lot of governance literature that's out there trying to piece these together, and sometimes somewhat successfully, but we want to, again, take a step back, try to sort of think through how these governance problems are manifesting themselves and what's going on with international intergovernmental organizations in response to these trends. So the data I'm about to show you is a data set that I've worked on through periodic release for about 20 years. And this is now going to be version 3 of this data. It's called the Correlates of War International Organizations Data. The IO data goes back to 1815, as you'll see, and essentially goes through the present, or roughly the present, 2015. So the dotted line are the number of formal, what we would declare as formal intergovernmental organizations. These have two main characteristics. To qualify to fit in this graph, you have to have a couple of things. You need a permanent secretariat. In other words, you have to have some kind of a headquarters. And you have to have more than two members. Right. Outside of that, that's it. If you've got a permanent secretariat, more than two members, you qualify. The secretariat part also has a subpart, which is you can't be an emanation, those things I just talked about. So if you were created in wholesale by another international organization, then you don't qualify to be, and we keep a separate list of those. But in terms of independent, core, multilateral organizations, this is what the population looks like. And noticed a couple of things here. One thing I'll go back in a minute. It's a slow rise, you know, that kind of correlates pretty highly with the total number of states. Correlates of War decides who's a state and who's not. It follows the UN. Basically, if you have a seat in the UN, you're considered a state by this measure. There are other measures out there. And so you can see really before World War II, this is fairly flat, small increases here and there, just like there's small increases in the number of states. But then, of course, in the post-World War II era with decolonization and the rise of cooperation after World War II, including things like Bretton Woods, you get a massive increase in the number of international institutions, although in the last decade to decade and a half, this has died off. Now, one easy explanation might be, and we'll talk about this in a minute, well, there aren't any more states being made anymore, and so there's no need to create more organizations. Yet part of the emphasis of the global governance literature is that we've got more problems than ever, and we've got fewer solutions. So if these are demand-driven organizations, why aren't we seeing a rise? Why don't they keep increasing? And so that's one thing I want to talk about. It's like, what has caused this flattening and what I would call the decline of international organizations? And of course, it's not going down. So that's the controversial title of the talk, but it has flattened out. And it's flattened out for a significant period of time, such that this is no accident, right? If this were 1 year, 2 years, you'd say, you know, this is a statistical anomaly, But this is clearly not the case, as there's now been several years where you see a decline. So this is also true if you break this down between region. It's not the clearest, easiest thing to read. Right, every region in that same post-World War II period experienced an increase in the number of regional organizations that existed. Right, and those two lines at the bottom are the Middle East and Asia, which are sort of the thinnest regions with international organizations. However, Africa, Americas, and Europe, the Americas and Europe, have all sort of tracked together. Interestingly, you know, Africa tops the list in many cases. Of course, there are far more states in Africa and far more regions within Africa, subregions within Africa, which surely accounts for this. If you were to look at the state level, like which states are the members of the most international institutions, European states take the top 10 almost in pretty much every measure. But there are fewer overall organizations in Europe, again, likely because there are fewer states. But again, just to highlight, A, there are differences between regions. Some regions are quite similar in terms of being fairly thin. Other regions are quite similar in terms of having fairly thick populations of institutions. Just taking a random sample of individual states just to show Europe, to give you one example. Again, you know, the number of individual memberships in international organizations. Take five, these are just kind of five random countries I pulled in Europe. Again, there's sort of a flattening out. You get this rise post-World War II. Actually, in Europe, it starts prior to World War II. It starts really with the end of World War I and then moves on and, again, flattens out. The Yugoslavia case, of course, as the war breaks out, Serbia itself is ejected from many international organizations or eventually let back in, which accounts for this rise. So again, it's a fairly flat recent decade, both at the international level, at the regional level, and then when you break it down and just look at states. So states appear to be abandoning this, or at least stopping the increase in the number of institutions that they form. So one thing I've sort of been playing with and thinking about is that if you think about so now we're back to the first graph, right? If you think about it this way, and you're looking at the number of states, number of international organizations were kind of a Cold War phenomenon, right? They were a post-war phenomenon. All the growth happens in this period. Outside of this, yes, you get some limited growth, especially in European organizations after World War I and during the interwar period. But outside of that, you know, you have very few until the beginning of the 20th century. There's a slight rise in the number. Again, that's pretty much focused on Europe. And then post-Cold War, they flatten out. And I'm not sure, you know, and most of our IR theory that we developed about institutions and liberal institutionalism were, of course, developed at the height of that growth, right, by Ruggie, by Cohen, by others, who wanted to explain this rise. But, of course, I don't think, and one of the, for those of you who are IR theory students or interested in IR theory, one of the calls I want to make is that I think we've kind of stopped theorizing, but we don't live in this historical moment anymore, and I think we need to think again about you know, why these institutions are in the growth trajectory that they are. And there have been a couple answers to this, which we'll talk about. Another way to look at this, you get a headache if you stare at this too long, is just, you know, creation rates, so birth rates. How many new IOs are born every year throughout this period? You can smooth this out, and it looks much nicer. And just using some low-S local smoothing. And again, you know, there's a small rise here, the rise transitions over, and then this shows the down, because it's, you know, it's smoothing, it's showing it starting a bit earlier, but it goes down. One group of scholars that has started to think about this, the recent paper in International Organization by Jessica Green, Ken Abbott, and Bob Cohen, have argued that, in fact, a theory called organizational ecology theory does very well at explaining this. So organizational ecology theory, in fact, suggests that, as we'll talk about a bit more in a minute, that because of competition, it's almost sort of like like an evolutionary process. Because of evolutionary competition between organizations for things like funding, some of them die, some get recreated, but more eventually die than are created. And then eventually there are certain ones that get legitimacy because of performance, others don't, and so they leave the sample. And in fact, the interesting thing, this their paper published about 3 years ago before I had this data, they created an ideal type graph. And they said, well, you know, if we had data on international organizations over time, here's what it would look like. And that was the graph. So so they were, you know, they were either correct ahead of time or I, you know, the data caught up to them. But, you know, this would be, from sociological theory, this would be the explanation, given this sort of competition explanation, and for what growth patterns would look like. Their argument, which I'll talk again a bit more in a second, is that international organizations do this, but what then happens, something has to take its place. Right? In the world of global governance, you can't have no governance, so something has to take its place. A couple of graphs just to finish the thought. The average size of international organizations is also leveling off. Again, probably a clearer way to look at that would be something like this. So when new international organizations are formed, they, again, during this sort of period of decolonization, you know, diffusion of power, they start getting bigger. New ones are bigger and bigger. Now newer ones tend to be smaller. And again, this is what many people have suggested has been going on with these small side agreements and small agreements made outside the purview of these larger organizations. Take one issue area, global health. So here we can catalog, this is sort of an early attempt through looking at various databases and doing some web scraping, trying to get a hold of how many NGOs are out there working in global health. And again, these are birth rates. These aren't existence. If you were to look at actual numbers, the NGOs would be far, far above. There are thousands of NGOs working in global health, whereas there are, you know, 100 working in, IGOs working in global health. These are the growth rates. The growth rates kind of align, interestingly, suggesting my first, when I went out and started, we started to create this NGO data, counting, just counting, nothing more complex than that, I would assume the global health NGO growth rates would be going up as well. And they do, but they kind of match the institutions, which tells you there's probably, there may be something else going on. This might be the something else, right? These are the emanations from global health. So these are organizations sort of creating themselves from other organizations. Those seem to certainly be on the rise. Again, they flattened a little bit lately. Self-described networks. So these are groups of NGOs or NGOs working with international organizations, working with states. Something like the Global Fund would be a part of this, would be a self-described network. The Gates Foundation actually self-describes as a network as well as an NGO. And so you've got this rise of private transnational regulatory actors that are getting involved in this. Again, just thinking about global health, you know, if you look at, okay, are there, these are looking at international organizations. So now we're going a little bit deeper. We're saying, okay, if you're an international organization working in the health field, how many links, how many formal links do you claim to have with other organizations in the health field, like your network? And again, you'll notice that over time, the network tends to fall. There are fewer and fewer global health linkages with international organizations. The same cannot be said with NGOs, where recently it's gone up. So again, you've got the rise of these networks going on in the health community, in the health NGO world, whereas it's not happening in the IO world. All right, why is this change happening? So why are we seeing this shift away from international organizations? Why are we seeing them stagnate? So I'm going to talk about a couple of things. I want to distinguish what I would call structural versus unit or issue level explanations, talk about material versus ideational explanations, and just emphasize, like, we're just sort of casting about for a typology. It's not a theory. It's not, typologies are not theories, but we're at least going to try to make some sense of some of the explanations that we've seen that are out there. Okay, so what are some, like, material changes that are happening at the systemic level? Well, the end of bipolarity, right, and the end of the Cold War. And it's, I don't think it's any surprise that you see the rise of non-governmental organizations happening about the time the Cold War ends. And if for no other reason, then there's all this sort of new space now, right, where during the competition of the Cold War, you know, NGOs by the West, by the United States in particular, were seen as a threat, right, as a way to sort of try to tear down these institutional structures that they had built up and wanted, you know, sort of ideological homogeneity in them. I think, in addition, a related explanation is that you know, there were a lot of issue areas the United States and Western powers claimed to care about in the guise of the Cold War. But when the Cold War ended and that competition died out, they were willing to diffuse power. They were willing to delegate, in other words, far more than they would have been during the Cold War. It's a possibility. Clearly, there are more actors out there. There are more NGOs than ever. There are more private organizations. There are more public-private trusteeships than ever. But what one thing we're still wrestling with is what accounts for the timing? Like, why did these really explode in the 1980s and 1990s? I think technology probably has something to do with this. Again, that's something we're not exploring in the world of international relations right now, but I think technology is a very important way to think about this. A boring one, but one that probably matters, is the number of states. How many states exist in the world? That gives you a sense of the demand for types of organizations, and as the number of states has stopped increasing at any kind of significant rate, that could be potentially, as I said, one explanation for why the number of organizations don't rise. Again, organizational ecology, this is the Abbott, Green, and Cohen argument. Again, the idea is it's a combination of sort of competition between for scarce resources between organizations, as well as sort of a legitimacy that certain organizations are viewed as legitimate by international society, others are not. So this creates both ideational and material competition, which then leads to some sifting and winnowing, as we might say, between organizations. I think some of the more, well, ideational as well, a couple of more interesting ones to talk about. One is what I would call ideological homogeneity, and there's two versions of this, right? Is the, you know, post-Cold War, you now just have the capitalist system. You know, there was no need for things like the Warsaw Pact anymore, because you had this sort of fall of the East, if you will, and therefore now those states began to join the existing quote-unquote Western organizations. The rise of democracy and the rise of pluralism could be one thing that accounts for the rise in the non-governmental organizations. As more and more states democratized, it allowed individuals more opportunity to interact with people from other societies, from other states. Technology also allowed this as well. Global rationalization, the rationalization argument is something we borrow from sociology, right? And the big rationalization often refers to this process, sort of a process of taking sort of traditional authority and thinking about sort of the rationalization of traditional authority, which means sort of the legitimate use of authority tends to leave what we'd call more traditional organizations. And in fact, the more rational legal authority, the traditional rational legal authority is taken over through you know, bureaucratic processes, et cetera. Again, sort of the idea that what is a legitimate organization is one that is highly routinized, highly legalized, et cetera. The more interesting ones, and this is going to take us down some different paths. So somewhat related to the end of the Cold War explanation, but somewhat different, is this idea of government ideology. Again, often sociologists try to distinguish things like markets versus hierarchies, right? How should groups be organized? And there's been a clear move, right, in the last 25 years to think more about markets, right? And you're not going to get out of here without a Polanyi quote here at some point, but I'll leave that for later. But, right, the embeddedness of markets and the abandonment of hierarchies and the government's, you know, in the post-World War era, post-World War II era, were about hierarchies, right, both domestically and internationally, and that now there's more of a move to markets, and we've seen with neoliberalism, et cetera, neoliberal economic policy. So that's a possibility. Adverse selection would be another one, right, that, you know, there are certain organizations that were created, there were easy problems, relatively easy problems to solve, they were solved. Now we've moved on to more difficult problems, which means you need different types of approaches, new organizations to be formed. I think another one to think through, and what I want to spend a little time on, is this idea of domestic hostility. And here, you know, I want to talk about how international relations theorists might want to think about, or potentially think about, the rise of populism and nationalism that we've seen in the last few years. So there are a number of prominent arguments in international relations that international organizations are fundamentally seen by domestic populations as good and legitimate. And there's reason to believe that. Some of this is from theory. Some of this is from this work that goes out, and they do public opinion polling. You know, they do experimental work, and they ask individuals, like, are you more likely to support an authorization to use force? Are you more likely to support foreign aid? Are you more likely to support trade, you know, if or if not an international organization kind of puts its stamp of approval on these? And overwhelmingly, that experimental evidence shows, at least in the U.S. and in Europe, people like international organizations. So that's sort of one stylized fact to think through. But the problem, of course, is that what we've seen, both obviously in the UK, but especially in the United States in the last few years, is somewhat open hostility towards international organizations and the goals that they want to accomplish. So how do we think about this? All right, so thinking about domestic politics. So sort of if you're an IR scholar or an IR theorist, there's a bit of an inside joke here. So from an IR scholar's perspective, what was the greatest danger of international organizations in the 1990s or the early 2000s? Was there a person? Was there a movement? Was there a thing you could put your finger on? And I would say, yes, it was John Mearsheimer. Was the biggest danger to international organizations, right? A realist international relations theorist who said, international organizations are worthless. All they do is funnel power from the great powers into some ends. There's a way in which the great powers can rule the world, and it is through international organizations, right? And so we all can thank John for that. He's the person we all love to quote for this. But of course, currently, if you ask even an international relations scholar who's the biggest threat to international organizations, this guy would probably top the list. So how do we make sense of this, right? Because it's clear that, and this is, you know, this is sort of one article from a couple of weeks ago now. You know, Trump is, for example, suggesting he's going to spend $50 billion more on defense, right? For those of you who don't know, the State Department's entire annual budget is $50 billion, right? So he's going to increase defense spending more than the entire budget of the State Department. Right. He has said time and time again, we're going to withdraw from many key international organizations, or he's going to, in fact, remove our representative from those positions. He's threatened this with the UN Human Rights Council. Of course, UNESCO is once again in the sights of the United States. Several key international organizations, not to mention trade deals, right? The U.S. has already pulled out of the TPP. And it's clear that Trump wants to change these things, and he wants to change the U.S. role in international organizations. Couple of points. One, sort of to mix headlines and IR scholarship. This is clearly a rejection of the realist worldview, ironically. Right? The realist worldview is the strong states get what they want in international organizations because they have control. Right? The U.S. gets what it wants in the IMF through structural adjustment. The U.S. gets what it wants through the World Bank by taking decades before approving things like environmental impact statements. Right? Case after case, where critics of these organizations suggest that the reason they behave badly is because the U.S. has too much say, or Western Europe has too much say, the developed world has too much say. But if that's true, right, why would conservatives in the United States in particular, and conservatives around the world increasingly, want to get out of these international organizations? Right? If the realists are right, that these things are just simply tools for great powers to go around and beat people over the head with, and this is recognized by conservatives, why change, right? And so ironically, I would argue what's fascinating about this sort of counter-liberal international order movement that's going on in the United States is that they're completely rejecting this traditional realist idea that it actually serves a purpose, and it's to help the United States, right? Rather, what they see is the constraining power of these organizations. And indeed, this is something the liberal IR scholars have talked about, like the Cohen and Ruggies of the world, right, have talked about the fact that these international institutions may serve to enhance wealthy states' power in some cases, but they also constrain, right? And it's that constraint that Trump and conservatives, increasingly the United States, don't like. So trying to make sense of that in some way, I think, from theory perspective, can be difficult. And of course, I know, you know, as much as I read in the papers about Brexit, but it seems to me there's sort of similar dynamics going on in the current case as well. So I said we weren't going to get away without some Polanyi. So one of Polanyi's famous theories, right, is this idea of the double movement, and sort of in the interwar period, right, that what he saw going on in the 20s and 30s was this process of the rise of markets and the marketization of labor, the marketization of anything going on in society. and that that marketization was disembedding institutions like markets from human interaction. Right, and his claim, among many others, some of his claims, were that part of the rise in violence in the interwar period and part of the struggle even prior to World War I, right, was about this tension between this double movement, the movement to markets, right, the movement to marketize everything, right, and the countervailing movement, which saw that as being harmful, right, and the rise of embedded social institutions in an attempt to bring the markets back. And so if the markets were going to have, right, if free markets were going to have complications for employment, for labor rights, et cetera, you needed social institutions, welfare, healthcare, et cetera, to sort of bring that back and re-embed them, right? So I want to suggest that something similar is going on with how states conceive of themselves acting in international law and international organizations right now, and that it's been going on for a while, but that it's sort of reaching a fevered pitch. I think populist, what I would call populist nationalism, right, is really leading some to reassert this idea of sovereignty, right? We don't want constraint. We want full autonomy over our policy, right? This is the rhetoric that is, the narrative that is often used. And therefore, we must get out or limit support for international organizations. They do not see this as a tool. Those who value the sort of the populist nationalists do not see this as a tool for advancing national interest. Quite the contrary, they see it as being a constraint against them. This is not new. It's clearly, I would argue, a fevered pitch right now. It is not new. One of my favorite pictures I love to show my courses on international organizations. This is Adlai Stevenson. He's behind the big thing. He landed at the Dallas airport in 1963 as a preview of President Kennedy coming, before, right, the trip in which Kennedy is assassinated in Dallas. He gets out of the plane in Dallas and is immediately mobbed by people with signs about the UN and about why are we in the UN? What is the US doing in the UN? The UN is undermining American sovereignty. And in fact, one lady there sticking her tongue out at Stevenson whacks him over the head with a board that says, get out of the UN. Right? This is a long undercurrent in American policy, that there has been a significant portion of the US, whether it's for isolationism or ideological reasons, who don't like international organizations. They don't want the US involved in them. They don't want funding going to them, and they sure the hell don't want any kind of limitation on American policy autonomy because we're members of these organizations. The guard next to Stevenson asked him if he wanted to arrest her, and he said, no, just send her to school. But at the same time, right, we read about global cosmopolitanism, especially under globalization, right, that, as I said, non-governmental organizations, human rights organizations, labor organizations, right, are crossing borders, private voluntary organizations for what we would call cosmopolitan causes are at an all-time high, right? You've got networks of non-state actors that are growing very quickly, very well-funded in many cases, right? Sort of, again, it's the dual action, right? It's the sort of get us out of here and keep, get, you know, take us out of the international order, right, which is clearly what Trump is aiming to do. And if you want to know some inside thinking about Trump, read Michael Anton's pieces over the last couple of months. Simultaneously, you've got a huge chunk of the population saying, no, we want to be embedded even more in these institutions, and this is where you tend to get societal conflict. Right? This is back from the 80s, right? Some of the initial AIDS activism. You could even go back further, the disarmament movement in the 70s, the human rights movement in the 60s in the U.S., right? The immediate and overwhelming response to the first executive order that Trump passed, right? And there's still, I can tell you, there's still crowds at airports waiting at international terminals for folks coming out and protesting, right? And so how do you put these things, where did these meet? Because unfortunately, one implication is if this doesn't get rationalized somehow, what you'll see in cases like the UK, I would argue, in the US, is as administrations change, you will see whiplash, right? You will see a complete abandonment of international orders and principles, and then when someone with different preferences comes in, you will see a complete re-engagement of it, and this will go around and around and around. Unfortunately, Polanyi essentially says, one thing that led to this the rationalization was, of course, the war. And we hope that's not what it takes for something like this to happen. So What are some challenges that we need to think about trying to explain and figure out how this process might rationalize itself? What is the public thinking? Where is the public at on these issues? Again, we don't have good theories about why non-state actors have exploded the way they have. Again, I think technology matters a lot. The ability to join an NGO on your smartphone in the next 5 minutes and pay a nice donation through PayPal, right? Something we've not seen before, that's new, that's causing more and more people to get involved in all manner of organizations. I think, again, the end of the Cold War provided an opportunity. It's hard to look at any database or any empirical analysis of NGOs and not notice a huge expansion in the size, the frequency of these non-state actors around the late 1980s and early 1990s. Again, the rise of the internet, right? This happens at the same time, so it's kind of hard to piece those things apart. Is there variation at the issue level? We'll go through this extensively, but I've shown you some data on global health. In human rights, the story is somewhat the same. The number of UN treaties has slowly increased, but at a very slow pace, a very methodical pace, which is the way that system is supposed to work under the UN human rights system, versus the internet, where you've seen very few efforts, and those efforts are usually led by the United States trying to shove its preferences down others' throats about internet governance, versus trade, where the WTO still sits right at the top of the sort of hierarchy of trade policy, I would argue, but yet states now trying to wrestle more control back from it, both in how they make side, like small trade agreements, NAFTA, TPP, TTIP, et cetera, and also how they're increasingly challenging, in some cases, the WTO itself. Our data on this is not good. Scholars have not gathered a lot of systematic data on these trends over time, partially because they're new and it's hard to do. Again, to go back to the story, right, what are people's preferences? What do people want? And one thing that, as a project we've been wrestling with, the initial title of this project was, Global Governance, The Rise of Small Ball. So for any of you who know this book, right, by Michael Lewis called Moneyball, right, the point of this, right, the argument of Moneyball, and yes, there's a Brad Pitt movie about it, if you want the short version, right, it's the idea that, there are certain teams in American baseball that don't have the money, they don't have the resources, they have to play the game a different way, right, they have to recruit different types of players, they have to sign different types of players, they have to fundamentally change their strategy on the field, to be competitive, right? And so Lewis's book was sort of outlining how this has evolved over the last 15 years, using the Oakland A's as a case study. Our interest was similar, right, in sort of saying what we see are, again, these big behemoth international organizations with 180 members that are very well funded, that we try to squeeze all the rules into, are starting to decline in their legitimacy, they're starting to decline in their activities, and we see all of these small ball. Right, we see all these small organizations breaking off, starting to do their own thing, and diffusing power over time. What people keep, first of all, people tend to hate the analogy, that's fine. But they also push us on, is this about preference or strategy? Right? Because one way you could say is, well, maybe people like small agreements, right? That they just, they're more likely to get what they want, and that this meets their preferences better if we go work with 5 states instead of 125 states. It's possible. It could also just be a strategy, right? You want to get the big organization, but you think the only way you'll get there is by making a bunch of small ones that then you can stitch together into, like, say, a multilateral climate solution, right? So again, think about climate or regional trade agreements. Is this going small a strategy, or is this what states really want? Does the United States like to pick off states 5 at a time or 3 at a time rather than trying to cajole them all within the WTO framework in trade or in climate? That's very possible. Again, or is it preferences over outcomes, kind of with different strategic objectives and how you want to achieve them? And finally, of course, the million-dollar question is, like, whose preferences matter? Do we still need to think about states, as Jendelson told us, at the center of this process? Do we need to think about bureaucracies within IGOs as mattering, non-state actors, firms, right, NGOs, mass publics? As I kind of indicated, I think there's a lot of work to be done there. And of course, right, are these changes for good? Right, like, if global governance is fragmenting, is this a good thing? Right, again, you can tell the story either way, right, that, the classic sort of federalism type story in the U.S., right? Well, you know, you devolve governance, you keep it down to the local level, you'll get solutions that are tailored, right, for individual regions, individual continents, individual states, and you'll get much, you know, more efficient outcomes that way. Of course, we also know that system has huge potential inequities within it, and it allows predatory behavior between regions as well. And so, at a very general level. And so, how does this all matter for, you know, rates of poverty, for, you know, development questions, for trade questions, for questions about the future of climate change, right? Like, is the small ball strategy, is sort of going small in climate going to work? Most scientists tell us no. It's frankly, it's already too late. But that if we're going to do something, it has to be fairly comprehensive and it has to tackle most of the main polluters, which you're not going to do sort of three at a time, all setting different standards over different time periods with different punishments. But again, we don't know, right? In the end of the day, will the WHO or the Gates Foundation do more to advance global health? Do they need to work in, they should work in concert. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And how do we think about that from an international relations theory perspective? Okay, so I haven't given you a lot of answers. I hope I've raised some questions, at least in your mind, about global governance in the future and how it's changing. And I thank you for your attention, and I really look forward to your questions. Thanks.
Okay, thanks so much for the lecture, John. We can open up the floor for questions. We have two stewards with microphones, so if you can put up your hand if you want to ask a question and make sure you wait until we have the microphone before starting to ask the question. Why don't we start right here in front?
Hi, thank you for the lecture. I think it's really inspiring. I come from a clinical medical background. I have been really interested in global health, so my vision, like my focus has always been on WHO and global health governance. So it attracted my interest when you mentioned global health as an example. I just want to ask you, from your perspective, from an international relationship perspective, what is so special about global health that you make it as an example in your speech, or you're just randomly picking something out? And the second question is about you mentioned the number of international organizations. I got the impression that the first international governmental organization was the League of Nations, so established only in 19-something. But according to your graph, I think at least one of them appeared in 18-something. So I was just wondering, what is your definition of the initiation of IGOs? Thanks.
Great.
Thank you.
Two great questions. So I'll take the second one first. So traditionally, scholars of international organizations argue that the first international organizations was something called the Central Committee on the Navigation of the Rhine. So it was an organization that was between several European states about, again, a public goods problem that needed to be solved, which is how do you navigate on this river that crosses several states, right? And so you couldn't just have one country. You couldn't just have Prussia or France regulating it. And so we tend to date that back because our definition is, again, right, permanent secretariat, more than two members, that is, quote-unquote, independent. So, I mean, the League of Nations is the first that gets a tremendous amount of attention, you know, established in Versailles. But we usually go back to 1815. So the first question on why global health, it wasn't completely random, which is that I do think a lot of the dynamics that we see going on in terms of fragmentation, in terms of competition between smaller international organizations happening in global health. And so we've, Cal and Michael and I have hosted a couple of conferences where we've invited both practitioners and theorists to come together, and it seemed to us that what sort of folks on the practitioner side in global health sort of are constantly emphasizing is what we would say is sort of a lack of cooperation. Like, yes, there's the WTO at the top. In theory, they're coordinating. But what most folks who have been out in the field tell us is, you know, when you really want something done, you know, it's Doctors Without Borders or it's the Gates Foundation, and then the WTO kind of catches up later. And the WTO has long been criticized for being inefficient and with resource allocation, et cetera. I don't have a position on that at all. But I would just say we chose global health, A, because I think of its substantive importance, and B, because we see a lot of interesting variation over the last 20 years, and some of the very dynamics that we have hypothesized are going on, we see in that area.
more questions, if you put your hands up. There.
All right, also from my side, thank you very much for your talk, first of all. I've got a theoretical question on liberal institutionalism or rational institutionalism, which you mentioned in your talk. So from a rational institutionalist perspective, institutions are created to tackle cooperation problems, and therefore states delegate certain powers, monitoring and sanctioning to those institutions. And how would this look like in a world where institutions are less formal, where you do not have like institutions like the WTO or the EU, but more network kind institutions? Who would monitor and who would sanction in such a setting?
Right, great question. So that's part of the challenge, I think, in thinking through how these networks, again, how, say, network theory meets up with institutionalist theory. And so, you know, a couple of people who've been thinking a lot about this, one not far from here, Duncan Snidle at Oxford, has actually written a lot on informal institutions. And he's increasingly trying to think about these very questions. And his answer is that, his hypothesis, and Felicity Fabulous, who's one of his students, will start at Pepperdine next year, what their argument is that, you know, just as in, for example, the human rights literature that makes arguments about things like naming and shaming, right, that there are sort of non-centralized enforcement processes that can happen even among informalized sectors. And so you can imagine some of those same mechanisms arising under informal governance. And so take something like the G20, or any of the G groups, which are informal. They would not be in here. There's no secretariat. They meet the number of states, but they're informal organizations, right? They're, in fact, the numbers of them and who's in them, right, changes significantly over time. So I think looking at some of these more kind of diffuse mechanisms, again, naming and shaming is the one that keeps coming to mind, it could be a substitute for that. But that is a challenge for these groups, and we've seen that time again in the G groups, G7, G8, over time as they have tried to put forward, you know, particular policy initiatives, and Russia or, you know, the U.S. or other groups have tried to shy away from that. And frankly, they use a naming and shaming, right? Like, the other states become very open about what they were trying to accomplish and why certain states defected, essentially using that sort of rational institutionalist nomenclature. And so that would be one of the first places I think we should look at. But, yeah.
I think just two rows behind, there was another hand up.
Thank you. You talked very early on about the rise of public-private governance, and I wondered if you could give a couple of examples of that, say if that's a trend that you foresee continuing.
So public-private type organizations or cooperative agreements have definitely expanded in recent years. This trend seems to suggest that these are going to continue to be on the rise. One challenge is we don't have a good, I was able to show you some data on counting such types of arrangements. There's not great data on public-private regulatory organizations. Cohane and, Ken Abbott actually has started a project along with a gentleman named Oliver Westerwinter to try to sort of nail down what these are. They've been working on this about 5 years, and they're just now getting around to starting to put some of this data together. Something I would put in this category would be something like the UN Global Compact, right? So you've got the UN working with private industry to try to create regulatory schemes about things like child labor, right? And so it's both a public in the sense that, you know, the states approved Kofi Annan moving forward with this years ago. They then reach out to private industry to try to create some joint regulatory process over that. Now, I think that's probably the biggest example of one, but there are other small ones. But it's my speculation would be they would continue to increase. I think this is where some of the very newest work is going on in terms of just cataloging and figuring out what are these, what do they look like, and so it makes it hard to predict the future. But
But the Global Compact is one that really started to get people rethinking. And some of John Ruggie's own work, both scholarly and with the Compact, is a place I might direct you to on these public-private partnerships. He's written extensively about them and was key to setting up the Global Compact himself. So,
yeah, let's just stay in that area. I'm trying to keep an eye on that.
Hey, John. So three very quick questions. The first question is, how much of the decline in IOs is explained by the amalgamation of a bunch of IOs into the EU in the 1990s?
Yep.
The second question is, sort of on behalf of our friend Julia Gray, who couldn't be here, she would immediately ask, how many of these IOs are zombie IOs just not doing anything? And the third question is, to what extent, to what extent are these alternative IOs, these smaller IOs, not necessarily working in opposition to the big multilateral regimes, but sometimes perhaps are used or created even to grant more leverage to the powerful states within the IO. So, for instance, NAFTA gives the U.S. leverage in the GATT-WTO.
Great questions. So, number one, decline of the IOs into the EU. That initial downturn that you saw is part of it, right? A lot of organizations disband or just get absorbed when the EU begins to move to Central Europe and to the East. But that accounts for sort of the initial downturn for a couple of years, but then that continues. And so there's something else going on there as well. How many of these are zombie international organizations? Probably a fair number, but it's not the zombies talking about it in morbidity terms, but the death of IGOs don't seem to be evenly distributed between those that we would consider to be like, I've never heard of this, versus organizations that seem to actually be, meeting regularly, have sizable budgets, et cetera, they get disbanded. So I think that's a key consideration, but I also think the death rate is fairly evenly distributed. You know, if you take like Julia's lists and look at that, the third one's hard, right? So yes, some of these. So there's a complementarity versus competition, right? And it's probably going to vary case by case. And again, what makes it really hard to answer this with the data that I showed you is most of the time we've taken the emanations out. So talking about Felicity's work again, both Felicity and Tana Johnson at Duke have extensively looked at these emanations and when they emerge, and both of them try to evaluate why are new organizations created, whether they're independent or especially when they're not independent. And it's interesting, both of them kind of come up with similar answers, which is that part of the time it is bureaucratic inertia, so bureaucracies trying to be independent, right, and wrestle control away from state pocketbooks, for example, and certainly state rules. They're trying to create slippage from like a principal agent perspective. The others are, yes, sometimes great powers or large states create these organizations because they see the bureaucracies being too strong and sort of holding up what they would want to do, so they create side agreements. Those would potentially more likely show up in our data because those organizations tend to be created not as emanations that are still related, but they're independent, right? It's just like, we're going to abandon this and move on to something else and create a new organization that's very different. So what you'd want to do from an empirical perspective is try to figure out, is really look at emanation creation rates versus what I would call spinoffs that are independent. But it's hard, and I don't have a good theoretical answer to that third question.
You still stay briefly in that area in the same row where you're standing.
Actually, it's a follow-up from the previous question. So I was wondering, what's the role of emanation? Because my hunch is that stagnation might be due to an increasing emanation that IOs are getting into in the last 20 years. I don't know. I don't know whether there is data or whether this could be a reasonable explanation.
Yeah, it could be. That's certainly a hypothesis. You know, if your theory is that one factor that drives states to
either abandon existing organizations to shut them down or to create side agreements with one another outside the framework is that, again, as I said earlier, they don't see that they can move through for whether it's bureaucratic political reasons or just frustration with, you know, their own voting power. And so they have the resources, as Professor Gruber would say, to go it alone. And they can hive off and sort of create their own own dynamics. Again, what we don't have is great data on emanations. We just don't have a good, because there's so many. And it sounds like a terrible reason, but again, I've had two PhD students take this on and spend a couple of years each trying to do this, and both of them, one came back with a random sample over 10 years, which seemed great. The other did it systematically and only got about 2 years worth of data. I mean, there are literally many, many hundreds of these that exist now. And so what role they play, I think, is a great question. And again, I kind of wish we had better data. Again, theoretically, your supposition makes sense. I mean, you can deduce that from basically like principal agent model. And so that would certainly be worth testing.
Yeah. Okay, we have one question there, and then we start moving. Oh, yeah, so you got something to do. Let's have that question first.
Hi, thanks for your talk. That was really great. So given the possible decline of global governance, what does this mean for military cooperation and, for instance, like in UN peacekeeping missions that are often transnational? Uh-huh. Do you see with, you know, Trump increasing the defense budget and such that declining as well?
I'll take the second part of that first because I think it's an easy answer. Yes, it will decline. I would be shocked if the Trump administration has any patience for UN peacekeeping for a variety of reasons. Not the least of which is, you know, in general, most everyone in that administration views the UN as inefficient, wasteful, and not particularly worth, you know, American resources. Now, if push comes to shove, if something like a multinational peacekeeping force is offered for something like Syria, could you imagine that happening? Could you imagine the politics behind that? Maybe in some weird way. So then he can claim victory. And it will be the best UN peacekeeping force ever, that I can tell you for sure. So I don't know. For military cooperation, you know, the interesting thing is, it sounds like you've thought about this some. My sense is that military cooperation takes place in one of two ways. One is through existing alliances or something like NATO, but mostly takes place through things like bilateral defense agreements, right? So what you normally see states doing are signing these sort of bilateral network or bilateral defense agreements, right? And there's actually some interesting work being done by scholar Brandon Kenny, who's at UC Irvine, who's just created an entire data set of these for about 50 years. And these go everything from agreements between states to do joint military exercises, to host bases, status of forces type agreements. And so, but it tends to happen in very small pairs. So, and I don't know his data that well, so I can't tell you if there are secular trends there, but I can tell you most scholars of global governance, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I could be wrong. Most scholars of global governance treat military cooperation as sort of a separate area, right? And it's because it's sort of done bilaterally in most cases. Now, part of Kinney's argument, in fact, his PhD thesis was, do having certain bilateral agreements help you make it, like, can you get hub and spoke type systems, right, where you get, you know, the U.S. agreeing with Panama and Costa Rica, and that makes it more likely that then we'll sign with Guatemala because Costa Rica will sign with, you know, that you'll complete all of the hubs in the spoke, right? And in that way, you do get a system, you get a network in that sense, but they all start initially as bilateral, which is somewhat different than what we see going in global governance, where occasionally it's bilateral, again, like the U.S.-China climate deal, but most of the time, there are multiple states involved. But
yeah. One hand over there, it's behind you here.
Thank you. So my question follows on from some of the earlier ones. I'd like you to take you to the East Asia region. Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of people would probably say that there's a growing number of institutions involving states in the region. But with your definition, of course, you may have a problem. in the sense that even ASEAN, you would not have counted, yeah, as an international organization, given that there was no secretariat between 1967 and 1976. So you would only count that as from probably 1976 onwards. Now, but there are other ones, right, like the East Asia Summit, the ASEAN Regional Forum. These are all very important institutions, and yet they don't have their own secretariat, right? They are run as a unit within the ASEAN secretariat. So I'm just wondering as to what that would mean, yeah, from the way that you're looking at things.
No, absolutely. And, you know, that's absolutely correct. And in fact, you know, if you remember the graph of the regional breakdown, Asia was fairly low. And one of my working hypotheses is because of this in cooperation, you know, to return to the informal idea, right? And not informal, informal in the sense that there's no secretariat, yet it's institutionalized. Informal doesn't mean not institutionalized, right? It just means there's no formal secretariat necessarily involved in the process. So, you know, the question is, if you were to relax that definition, and you were to add those in, the Asian region would have a sort of a thicker set of institutions there. You know, if we think about the ARF, you know, the AIIB, right, which is getting a lot of attention of late, which would qualify for this data. I guess the ultimate question is, you know, what, and again, I'm no expert on the region, why were those particular decisions made to create cooperation in those ways, right? Like, why not, you know? Those are emanations of a type. They're almost informal emanations, if you want to think about them that way, because they are linked to ASEAN, but not great powers. Sure. No, that's right. That's right. And so, and in fact, right, you could argue, not knowing a tremendous amount about the continuing dynamics of the region, but, you know, ASEAN, sort of without China, right, and in fact without the great powers, as you said, the great power in Japan, sort of that. Yeah, I don't have a great answer for you other than just to say I do think that is a particular set of emanations or spin-offs that I think are fairly unique. Not completely unique, but fairly unique, and they're the most dense in Asia. That said, I still think if we added those types, if we revised the definition, I still think Asia would still lag a bit. Now, what that means in the end, again, we're kind of trying to work out. But I do think it would move. And again, the other sort of not very institutionalized region is the Middle East. And there you don't really see the same dynamics. You don't see the League of Arab States or other similar regional organizations creating the GCC, right, creating sort of informal yet related organizations that that are spun off essentially. So it's a very good question. I would have to think about that more. Over there.
Thank you. This question actually led on to one small one I had, and then just a second one. I was just curious about, I was looking at the plateaus in your graph and really trying to rack my brain what might explain this. And I was just wondering, I hesitate to use the phrase, but how you might think of something like the rise of China, rising Chinese power, and what this means for your story of IOs in historical time. And second, your talk was making me think a lot about the real idealism of the post-war IOs. The UN saving future generations from the scourge of war, the World Bank, you know, eradicating world poverty by 2040, this sort of thing. And I was thinking of those plateau moments, you know, these really tough litmus tests, the 2008 financial crash, ISIS, this sort of, you know, really tough tests on these clearly very idealistic promises. And if you see any explanations just in world events empirically that would potentially contribute to this idea that there's some tough tests. Or are these, or instead, would you see these tests kind of are constant and nothing special about that period in time? Thank you.
That's a good question. We'll start with the rise of China. I mean, again, as I alluded to earlier, the rise, you know, the creation of China creating sort of the new development bank, right, on the sort of World Bank IMF type model, I think was a again, not being an expert in the region, but from an IO perspective, like this seems very significant in that, you know, if you really wanted to announce that you were, one hypothesis would be, if you're really going to announce that you're going to change the system and overturn the system and the way it's organized, like you would create something that didn't look like these other organizations in terms of design. Maybe design isn't that important, because then I think China's response would be, well, the design isn't that important, but what we do and in terms of conditionality, et cetera, that's where the difference is going to lie. And this has been the rhetoric anyway. But otherwise, you know, I'd have to think through the rise of China's power as a reason for that plateauing. But it's possible. So I have a mixed answer for, you know, are there these key events? You know, the narrative of the financial crisis was that the institutions did pretty well. Right, if we believe Dan Dresner and others, right, you know, the WTO did what it should. It stopped protectionism, right? The IMF intervened where it needed to. Was it perfect? No one would say it was perfect. But the narrative of IR scholars is these institutions did what they were supposed to do. They stopped this from spiraling out of control, as we saw in the 20s, and you still had general international cooperation throughout the financial crisis. ISIS, you know, on one hand, different in that I don't think you see a lot of people suggesting that the system has worked on any level, whether it's with immigration, whether it is with military cooperation. That said, these sort of military crises seem to be all very quite common, and you could find a lot of them where the institutions probably didn't perform the way they should have. You know, years ago, Bob Jervis made this distinction between multilateral economic and multilateral military cooperation, arguing that economic cooperation was always going to be more likely because in the end the stakes were lower. I've never kind of bought that, but then it's hard to look empirically, and no one's really kind of tried to systematically tease that out. But anecdotally, you know, maybe he was right. So.
There's one hand up at the very back.
Thank you. So you mentioned cosmopolitanism, and so I wanted to have your thoughts about the role of the non-state actors, because so far I feel we have they have been introduced as a challenge to international organization, but according to cosmopolitanism, I know it can be seen as a huge utopia, but non-state actors should be the future of international organization. As less relying on state framework, but more on a real international community from bottom up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. That's right. I mean, it's similar to the question of, you know, are these emanations, or these other organizations, these small organizations, are they complementary or are they contradictory? Right. And so, and again, IR theory hasn't said much about this from a deductive standpoint, I don't think, but we know that there are certainly some organizations that view non-state actors as key. Again, I think one of the debates I see play out in the literature is, you know, are non-state actors complementary in the sense of they have things like local knowledge, ground-up resources that these institutions don't have and can make them more efficient, more effective, more legitimate? Right. I mean, the legitimacy question is huge when it comes to how non-state actors, and that's where, again, a lot of the scholarship has been. There's also the countervailing thoughts, which is that for some international organizations, they view it as a challenge, you know, that the WTO is case in point. You know, they view non-state actors a little less so these days, but for decades, they viewed non-state actors as someone that would not be let in the door. And that, you know, this was a state-led and state-based organization, and that having NGOs involved, right, you can't have too many actors at the table. There's a somewhat related critique of NGOs and NGOs activities and IGOs that's out there by folks like Jim Rahn, who argues that, you know, at the end of the day, NGOs are usually chasing the money, and that they're just as self-centered as states when it comes to how they interact with IOs and global policy. I think he has a very obviously cynical take on NGOs that I don't necessarily agree with, but that argument is out there. But right, and I think, so the way I would think about this is that I think where the differentiation probably comes in is with issue area. I think there's some issue areas where almost across the board, NGOs are seen as allies, not adversaries. How much of an ally, unclear. So global health, I think they're often seen as an ally. I think in the trade and finance world, they're seen as adversaries. And I think in development policy in general, they're seen as positive, but I do think there's some mixed arguments out there on that. So I agree, non-state actors, they could be a challenge. They could be a way for IOs to delegate all kinds of jobs that the IOs don't have the resources or capabilities to carry off. But then the argument goes, as they delegate more and more, as the NGOs get more and more power, is there a point at which states say, wait a minute, we've lost control, and they either try to wrench that control back or they go off, leave the NGOs to do their thing, and they create other international organizations to do what they want to do in the first place. Again, that's a very state-centric view. But the normative angle you're getting at of sort of the bottom-up versus top-down, I think, is important. And I guess the one thing I do think James Ron's work helps caution us about is that, you know, not all non-state actors are out to do good, and that we can't have this view of non-state actors as being always out there to help and to deliver aid. You know, there are lots of nasty non-state actors out there as well that are self-centered and could make matters worse.
More questions? Yes, over there.
I was interested by your characterization of the Cold War as sort of a golden age of international organizations. And I was also interested in the way you described, so the realist take on the international organizations is that they are essentially tools of the great powers. So I see a lot of truth of that. But if you go back to the Cold War period, you know, I began my government career in the 1980s in Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. And in those days, we certainly didn't see the UN as a useful tool. Our view then would have been that the hopes of held by the founders for the Security Council had been stymied by the superpower rivalry, which meant that anything important was vetoed by one side or the other, and the UNGA had just become a third world debating society, and it was a great way for a lot of American money to be flushed down the drain or flushed into the pockets of a lot of third world bureaucrats. And it seemed to me that if there was a golden age of American UN relations, it was really from about 1990 to, I would mark the end as, I would kind of ring down the curtain in 2003 with the bombing of the UN building in Baghdad. So was the Cold War really the causal factor, or were the IOs going through their own life cycle would just happen to coincide with the Cold War?
Right, it's a great question. So I first want to make a distinction between golden age as being sort of the golden age of growth in the number of these and the rise and how states would turn to international organizations as sort of often one of the first levers, a solution to global problems. So, you know, I don't disagree at all with your characterization of the UN or the Security Council during the Cold War as being completely stymied by this rivalry. And in fact, right, the great hope of with the fall of the Berlin Wall was that the UN would be useful now and we'd get peacekeepers everywhere. And initially we did get a lot of peacekeepers, and post-Bosnia and, you know, post-Somalia, then that comes crashing down only to come back, right? So, you know, in the early 2000s. And so I do want to make a conceptual distinction between sort of how states think about international organizations as being one of the go-to levers of foreign policy and cooperation versus, you know, the UN in particular at that time and its effectiveness of doing things on the ground. So I don't disagree with that. But you're right, under the Reagan administration, you know, but again, compare the Reagan administration's view of the UN to the Trump administration view. I think neither are particularly friendly, but the current administration and even the Bush administration seemed more willing to withdraw and to just retrench a bit more. I mean, fair enough, Reagan withdrew us from the ICJ before the Nicaragua decision, but so there's that. But again, what I'm seeing as the main trend that I want to try to think about is, like, why are states turning to this traditional organizational form for this period of time that coincides with the Cold War, and you see the rise of these. And you could say, well, it was just the developing world that were creating these to try to imitate what was going on amongst the, you know, the EU or the great powers in some way. But the data suggested that that was happening, but as the U.S. was still joining. The U.S. was still a joiner, even in the Reagan years. You know, we were still joining new organizations at the time, and we're not anymore. And I don't think that means we're not joining any organizations. I think the style and type of organizations are different, and that's kind of what I want to try to get a sense of, is that why are states abandoning this traditional form of cooperation and thinking about something else, even if those traditional forms may not have always worked or certainly had their ups and downs in terms of policy outputs.
Yes.
Can I ask a kind of a slightly technical question, more developing on this discussion? Have you looked how many countries were participating in global organizations before, during the Cold War, and how many are participating right now? Because obviously after the Cold War ended, there were lots of countries in Eastern Europe, Russia, former Soviet Union countries that joined many international organizations. And initially, I guess, the strategy was that everyone going in the same direction, but now we see that there are some differences, right, even at the EU, between Eastern Europe and Western Europe. Do you think it can partially be the reason as well that, first of all, more countries are joining the same organizations, and secondly, for the reduced interest of the U.S. and other big players, one of the rationale can be that smaller countries and new countries, they're having more say, and probably they want to move in a slightly different direction? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, great question. So the pre-post-cold, right, so... And this goes somewhat back to James's question a bit. You know, James was asking, does the increase in membership in the EU account for this? Because some of these organizations formed in the aftermath of the fall of the wall were also then shut down once some of these states started. So something like the Hexagonal, right, is created immediately after the end of the Cold War by, you know, Hungary and the Visegrad states and some of the neighbors to the east. And then as they start to be let into the EU or offered, you know, potential membership in the EU, they start closing these down. And so that could account for some of it. I think it accounts for this initial, the initial downturn in the number of organizations. But that downturn has continued to stay flat, even after these sort of post-Cold War organizations that sprouted up have now all either disappeared or become... seem to be more long-running. Part of that also is would sort of the, you know, these newly free and autonomous states, I mean, they were sovereign states, but now newly autonomous, were they running out and creating more organizations? And again, they were, but so were other states at the time. It was mixed in with a lot of other states. And, you know, the second part of the question, you know, it is, again, something we're really trying to nail down. Like, has it been that as the number of states has increased in the typical international organization, have the strong states or the states that would argue fairly or unfairly they're paying the bills not getting what they want? Are they, right, hiving off and doing something different because it's moving in a direction that they don't like and that they don't find agreeable? That is certainly going on. But again, I don't have an answer, but my question is, like, why now, right? Why is this the strategy? Again, there have been previous American presidents who have said, I don't know about this, but they've not threatened as clearly as Trump or even what Bush did of getting out and forming new ones. And so I'm interested in explaining that timing of that shifting in the strategy, because there have always been sort of new groups of states throughout the Cold War sort of coming, you know, becoming independent or becoming autonomous, and many of them followed the same strategy. But at any of those points, the great powers didn't start pulling the plug, and you didn't see them stop to turn to international organizations. And so kind of why now is what I'm interested, is I think the hard part of that to answer.
We do have time for a last question.
There you go.
Hello. My question for you is, as the world is becoming more globalized, is it fair to argue that large TNCs probably could act as an alternative to IGOs?
transnational corporations? Well, they're trying. Many of them are trying. And I think this is the origin of some of these public-private partnerships is firms would argue that they can do a better job of regulatory policy than international organizations because they have, this was the classic argument for the Global Compact, was that they were able to affect change more quickly. They were able to have material, they could have strong material incentives to get local actors to cooperate, and that, they were less bureaucratic, more efficient, et cetera. That argument is fine as far as it goes, but we also know a world without checks, regulatory checks starts to look, also doesn't look that great either. And so I think one reason more and more people are interested in these public-private partnerships is to find some hybrid model, right, where you're getting cooperation between transnational corporations and MNCs in regulatory policy on governance issues. There are some relative success cases. There are some failures out there. And so I think the jury is still out. But I think that is a trend. As I said earlier, it's hard to know exactly where it's going, but I think it is a trend, and certainly a lot of people are making this argument.
Okay, thank you. I think we have to start wrapping up. Did you have a question? Sorry. It looked like your hand was going up in the last minute to grasp the opportunity. So thank you to all of you for coming, and thank you for engaging in discussion. I mean, it's been a great pleasure listening to you, John. Thank you for making the time for talking to us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.